Psych Podcast, the podcast where we discuss all things intro psych. I am joined, as always, by my friend and colleague, Paul Bloom. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
I'm doing well. A little nervous because today we're talking about a topic that is a particularly important topic.
It is. We're talking about clinical psychology, abnormal psych. It used to be called psychopathology, the study of mental illnesses. And I guess we should start by saying that neither one of us is a specialist in this area.
Yeah.
There's a deep divide in our field, I think, between clinical psychology and everything else. And we're in the everything else category.
Clinical psychologists do things like actually treat patients when they're in grad school, which we do not do.
It's interesting. So many people, when they hear where psychologists say, oh, what are your patients like? I have a problem. I want to talk to you about it. But most psychologists are like us. They study language or memory or development or social interactions. Clinical psychologists are their own separate thing. The psychologist Susan Fisk, who is not a clinical psychologist, when she's asked what she does, she says, I'm a psychologist, but I'm not the type that helps people. And I think you and I fall into that category.
Any help that we provide to people is a complete side effect.
Yeah, totally unintended.
And that means that as you and I were preparing for this, we're a little bit humbled by the amount of information that is out there about mental illness, but we're going to give it our best. We have colleagues who have helped us out, helped you write your chapter on this.
Yes. In my book, I have a chapter on clinical psychology, and I had several clinicians, people who I really respect, who really are in the trenches here, look it over, give me comments, and you know, as I say about every chapter, when there's mistakes there, these are the points where I didn't take their advice. You know, in some way, this is a continuation of our individual differences discussion we had a little while back.
Yeah, I was about to say that clinical psychology is fundamentally about differences. It's just that the differences that they're interested in are the differences that are maladaptive. So not just who's extroverted and who's not, who is painfully shy, who is severely depressed.
That's exactly right. There's a lot to be said about normal human variation. Everybody has a somewhat different configuration of traits that leads to a different personality, different style of dealing with people, different degrees of aggressiveness and politeness, openness to experience. But clinical psychology is interested in the variance that leads to trouble, leads to pain, as in depression, as in anxiety disorders, dissociative disorders. But it can be seen as in some way, looking at a certain sort of human extreme.
I think that it's probably good to set the stage for when we're talking about mental illness. What are the big categories that we're referring to here? How do clinicians divide up the world of psychopathology?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. There's so much to say here, but I'll just quickly summarize what I see as the three main disorders that clinicians talk about. And then you and I are going to go off in different directions and talk about different things. So one is schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is not the most common mental disorder. Actually, only about 1% of people in the world suffer from it, but it's terrible. The life expectancy for somebody with schizophrenia is more than 15 years less than somebody without, due to suicide, illness, and accidents. And it's something which strikes people when they're young, usually in their late teens and their mid-30s. And it involves a cluster of problems. People with schizophrenia might have hallucinations where they see or hear things that aren't really around. They might have delusions or bizarre beliefs like they're Jesus Christ or they're being tracked by aliens or by the government. Often they have disorganized speech. They often talk in like gibberish. And sometimes they have odd and inappropriate behavior, strange giggling, wearing odd clothing, becoming sort of frozen in place. It's this terrible illness. And so that's one of them. A second thing to talk about is mood disorders, which are far more common. About 15% of men and 26% of women suffer from, or at some point in their life, of major depression, which, as you could imagine, involves sadness. But also involves other problems like a lack of interest in sex, problems with sleeping, problems with eating, and a various other sort of cluster of psychological problems that kind of revolve around sadness. And that's one mood disorder. Second mood disorder is bipolar disorder, which is when you have great sadness, but it also alternates with periods of mania, when you need intensive activity, often, you know, reckless actions. And then the third category is anxiety disorders, and these are the most common. About 1 in 3 people get it in their lifetime. Like mood disorders, more common in women than men. And this comes in different flavors. You could have generalized anxiety disorder, where you worry about things all of the time. You could have phobias, intense irrational fears of things. You could have obsessive compulsive disorder, which is technically speaking, in psychologists in the category, it doesn't get categorized with anxiety disorder, has its own special category, but it plainly involves anxiety, or you have these sort of obsessive thoughts, and then you're compelled to do something to make the thoughts go away. You might worry your hands are dirty and then obsessively wash your hands, or you left a door unlocked and you have to obsessively check the door, and it leads to considerable misery. There's so much to say about each of these disorders, but I'll just make two general comments about them. One is that they all seem to be the causes seem to involve some combination of genes and environment. So if I know that your biological mother or your biological father has had schizophrenia or depression or an anxiety disorder, I can guess that you're more likely to have it, even if they didn't raise you. It gets carried to some extent in the genes. But we also know it's not 100%. So even identical twins, one could have a mental disorder, serious like schizophrenia, another one doesn't. And that shows it has to be also due to something happens in your environment, often maybe some sort of trauma. And then the second thing to point out is there's these broad categories. There's other categories that psychologists talk about, like dissociative disorders, including so-called multiple personality disorder, dissociative identity disorder. And we put people in these broad categories, but there are actually relationships between them. So in particular, mood disorders and anxiety disorders tend to kind of fall together. And in fact, some people believe they're not really two separate things. The same drugs could be used to treat one and treat the other. So there's a lot more to say, but that's sort of a broad picture of what mental illness looks like.
The phrase that we're taught when we study these disorders that you were referring to when you're talking about the genes and environment interacting is the diathesis stress model. The idea being that you might have a propensity, but there is some sort of trigger in the environment that will cause you to develop a disorder, some sort of psychopathology. You might imagine that this is one of the biggest questions that clinicians can ask, which is why do people develop these disorders? So there's been a ton in the past 30 years or so of research trying to find various genetic causes to find what features of the environment or what features of the individual are most likely to trigger some kind of mental illness. And just in line with what you were saying, like there are no easy answers. It would be wonderful if we could find the one gene that caused schizophrenia or depression. We would have some hope for turning it on or off. But as with many psychological traits, these are caused by multiple genes working together.
And that's right.
We're barely scratching the surface, really.
It's complicated both the genetic level and environmental level. So at the genetic level, nobody believes there's a single gene for bipolar disorder or dissociative disorder or whatever. There's a genetic propensity, but it involves a large cluster of different genes working together in the same way that how tall you are involves a cluster of different genes working together. The idea of a gene for schizophrenia is like the idea of a gene for height, which is just not on the table. So the genetic stuff gets complicated. And then the environmental stuff gets complicated. So nobody knows precisely what in the environment. You have two identical twins. They have the same genetic endowment. One becomes schizophrenic and the other one doesn't. What's the difference in their lives? A lot of people believe it could be due to some sort of trauma of the sort you could imagine, like being assaulted or something that just, you know, affects you deeply. And that could kind of push you over the edge. That's the stress in the diathesis stress model. Some people think it could just be various random events. We know generally stress is related to mental illness. Well, I think we'll talk about this later in more detail, but people who are poor suffer from more mental illness than people who are rich. And I think a plausible theory here is that it's very stressful, very tough to be poor. But yeah, looking at the causes of these illnesses is complicated.
So you've outlined these categories of mental illness. You know, what we always refer to as the Bible of mental illness is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders that is published by the American Psychiatric Association. And that is where we get the categories. Since we've been studying psychology, it's been through probably four or five revisions. So things get shuffled and categorized differently. There's also the World Health Organization has its own scheme for organizing these things. But that all leads to the question, what is mental illness?
Yeah,
We talk about it as illness. And you might ask the question, is the term illness here meant as mere metaphor? Or is the idea that, like any other disease, depression is a disease, schizophrenia is a disease? Now, I think most people, especially people who are not in this field, would probably immediately say, no, we mean it literally, I think, when we say depression is a disease. And that's changed in our lifetime, actually. I think there's been a big push to categorize these things as diseases for lots of good reasons. For one, we're less likely to blame people for these psychopathologies if we treat them as diseases. Another is that insurance companies will pay for treatment if we label them as diseases. But this is not without controversy. There are some people who don't believe that the medical model is the right way to think about mental illness at all.
So you can imagine a couple of extremes. One extreme says, well, you know, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, which are in the DSM. Well, all of the rest of the mental disorders we're discussing, schizophrenia, bipolar depression, unipolar depression, and more things too, personality disorders, which we'll talk about and so on, they're all exactly the same as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. If you looked hard enough, you could localize the physical problem in the brain. We could study its causes, but it's in some way you should think of it like you think of a disease like cancer. That's one extreme. The other extreme is what we've been calling mental illness is not only just a metaphor, but it's a bad metaphor. And I associate this view with Thomas Szasz. And I know you've done some reading of him, some study of him.
Yeah, I think he's probably the most famous proponent of this idea. He wrote a number of books on it, but the most famous one being The Myth of Mental Illness. And what he argued was that, yeah, these are not disease categories. He believed that it was a mistake to call psychopathologies mental illnesses. For one, he thought that this was opening the door for a sort of mistreatment of patients, like getting them into this system and treating them like patients was robbing them of their autonomy and their liberty. He thought that pathologizing problems like depression was ignoring the real source. He thought these were fundamentally social psychological responses to life and what might be happening in your life. But that to call it a disease was to do damage to the person who was suffering from it and to hide the ways in which you would really treat it. So he was himself a psychiatrist. It's not that he didn't believe that therapy helped. He just thought that what therapy was doing was addressing a fundamentally different kind of problem. It was just the problems that people have about how to live their lives in a complicated world.
Yeah. And I think at least I'm going to come to reject that view and say that that view is mistaken. But I have to give it credit that in some cases it's right, or it was right and it is right. So there are a lot of examples we could think of. In the DSM-2, homosexuality was in there as a psychological problem that needed treatment. And it was only after the social movement around that time and a lot of very brave activists arguing against it that it got changed in the DSM-3. The reason why it got counted as a mental illness is people disapproved and they thought it was immoral. So they thought it was ill. In the Soviet Union, they used to lock up dissidents, but sometimes they put dissidents in psychiatric institutions, because if you're arguing against the communist system, you must be mentally ill. And that's sort of Szasz's point, where you take something which is maybe a reasoned response, maybe an unpopular response to a situation, you pathologize it and you strip away from people the respect of disagreeing with them, respect of saying this is somebody who has a controversial view. You say, no, they're just sick in the head.
You know, Szasz points out that this could have been for reasons that weren't nefarious at times. So he, in one of his books, talks about the Catholic Church and the role that they might have played in this. Now, I haven't fact-checked this, but the idea was that when people died by suicide, it was viewed as a sinful act. And family members were told that their relatives weren't going to go to heaven because this person had taken their own life. And what he argued was that in these cases, there was some pressure to say, no, this wasn't a moral decision. This wasn't a decision born of free will and autonomy, but rather they were suffering from a disease. And because of that, they weren't acting as moral agents. Therefore, God would be fine letting them in. And so at least one route of this disease model might be to not cast blame on individuals.
That's nicely put. There's sort of two things on the same track. One is that sometimes it could be an insult to somebody, enormous amount of disrespect not to take them seriously, to say you're just mentally ill. But the flip side is sometimes it properly absolves them of responsibility. If you end up stabbing somebody because you're have a hallucination that they're a monster or something, you shouldn't be held morally
like the son of Sam.
Exactly. There are a lot of sort of people who do terrible things are or were mentally ill. So you might still lock them up to keep other people safe, but you don't hold them blameworthy the same way if you murdered somebody, you know, in a jealous rage, or if you murdered somebody for money or something like that. And then there's another aspect of this, and we talked about this before offline, which is a point I think made kind of clearest by Johann Hari, which is in some cases we acknowledge that an experience like sadness could be a normal response to the way the world works. So, you know, if one's child has just died, just got hit by a car and died, and you're just miserable about it, nobody's going to say you're mentally ill. You say, oh, that's just a normal mind working in a normal way. The person might get treatment or something, but still, we don't see that in some way as any way akin to an illness or disease. But Hari argues, once you accept that, and in fact, that isn't a DSM, those sort of grief exemptions. Once you accept that, then it opens up the door for other things. So I'll quote from him. He writes, "Why is death the only event that can happen in life where depression is a reasonable response? Why not if your husband has left you after 30 years of marriage? Why not if you're trapped for the next 30 years in a meaningless job you hate? Why not if you have ended up homeless and you were living under a bridge? If it's reasonable to use one set of circumstances, could it be other circumstances where it's also reasonable?"
A lot of mental illness is probably a normal response that for whatever reason has become extreme. We're supposed to have fear and anxiety about some things because it keeps us from doing really dumb things. It's when it gets to be disruptive, and this is a word that's often used, is this becoming a problem such that it is disrupting your quote-unquote normal functioning. This is one of the things that makes me sympathetic to arguments like Zaza's. Clearly, there is a lot of interpretation and social construction about what is adaptive, and answering the question of what is maladaptive might crucially depend on what situations you're adapting to. So is the current society or culture or familial environment making it such that what you're experiencing is disruptive? The very same symptoms might not be in another culture. So in some cultures where you're expected to mourn for long periods of time and not do anything but mourn, this would not be a mental illness. But in cultures like ours, where you maybe are expected to get back to work within a week, if you're still grieving hard after 6 months, people might think that this is mental illness. They might call it a mental illness. And that it bothers me that what we describe as mental illness on this disease model might actually turn on stuff that physical diseases wouldn't. If I have a flu, it doesn't matter whether or not the society that I'm living in thinks that it's wrong to cough and sneeze.
Yeah, but I would still push for a distinction. So you take somebody who's suffers from schizophrenia and is just unable to care for themselves. And I think everywhere, at every time, every place, this person is suffering and will be at a disadvantage. Somebody with a social phobia that they can't speak to people, somebody who has major depression, so severe they can't do anything. When you get to the extremes, the illness nature seems to be, I think, more clear, less subjective. But then you get, and you know, to be fair, it's not as if psychologists and psychiatrists haven't noticed this. You get to certain categories where there's honest debate over where to put them. And I'm thinking here about what psychologists call personality disorders. And we talked before about how, in some way, we're talking more about individual differences here. And personality disorders are a case where we can argue about what counts as normal variation, what counts as pathology.
And those are such an interesting category.
So what do they include?
Borderline personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder.
Why are you thinking, can you define borderline and histrionic?
Borderline personality disorder is when someone has a pervasive pattern of abrupt emotional outbursts, fear of abandonment, unhealthy attachment, altered empathy, instability in relationships, self-image, identity, behavior, and affect, often leading to self-harm and impulsivity. Histrionic personality disorder is a pervasive pattern of attention-seeking behavior, including excessive emotions, an impressionistic style of speech, inappropriate seduction, exhibitionism, and egocentrism.
Yeah, and you could see for all of these wider judgment calls. What's the proper level of seductive behavior?
Well, yeah, you read the definition of histrionic personality disorder, and it sounds like a Victorian husband chastising a wanton woman.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It sounds like a moral judgment that's being made on somebody.
You're not the first to notice the gendered nature of some of these categories. They sort of correspond to certain negative female stereotypes, and often it's women who get the diagnosis. However, then we get to what we're both interested in talking about, which is there's one personality disorder which is mostly male. Antisocial personality disorder, which gets coded in slightly different ways in other classification schemes under a better known name of psychopathy.
We've emphasized, you were emphasizing earlier, something that's deeply true and important, which is that sometimes people romanticize certain kinds of psychopathologies, but people suffer with these. With personality disorders, it's more like the people around you suffer.
That's right.
It's almost part of the disorder to not think that anything is wrong with you. So these people don't seek out therapy usually. And when they are in therapy, they're extremely resistant to therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So one reason why I believe things like serious phobias or bipolar disorder are diseases, illnesses, is because of the distress they cause people. I don't think that's necessary, but that's necessary. You know, people are miserable. It destroys people's lives and they want treatment. They want to get better. But the personality disorders, like you say, don't fall into this. There's, I think, a debate in the field as to whether they're impossible to treat or just very difficult to treat.
Right. There's no drug therapies that we know of. There's nothing like exposure therapy like we have for phobias that seems to work. And I don't want to say that people with these disorders aren't suffering. Of course, there are plenty of people who are suffering. It's just not in the same way is it part of their disorder.
And then you get to something. And in fact, for the narcissists, probably, I don't know what the data are, but I bet some of them are fairly cheerful in their narcissism.
I mean, that is a problem with narcissism. If you ask a narcissist if they have a narcissistic personality disorder, they will not only agree, they'll embrace it. They believe that they, in fact, are more valuable.
I read this. It was a popular treatment by John Ronson called the psychopath test. He's talking about psychopaths. And he goes and says that he does a lot of work on talk and gives talks on psychopathy. And often people come up to him quite concerned. And they want him to know, you know, am I a psychopath? And his answer is always, if you're curious about it, if you're worried about it, then you're not one.
Yeah, that's a great story. But I have to add my own story about this. I gave a talk at a maximum security prison because Cornell has a prison education program. And among the topics that I touched on, one was psychopathy because I was giving a lecture on morality and moral judgment. And at the end of my talk, a prisoner came up to me and said something very similar, said, is psychopathy possibly genetic? And I said, you know, there is some evidence that there is. I said, why? Are you worried that you might have it? And he said, yeah. I said, well, why? He said, my mom told me that my dad had these psychopathic traits, you know, and I see them in myself. So I was very fascinated by this. So I went and I asked one of my friends who works with psychopaths, and he said exactly what you just said, which is, if they're concerned about whether or not they have psychopathy, then they're not psychopaths. But then I went to another friend, also an expert on psychopaths, and I told them the story, and they said, that's just what a psychopath would say. they would try to convince you that they were genuinely caring in their the manipulative nature.
That's psychology in a nutshell.
Really,
predict both ways and really this happening.
This episode of Psych is sponsored by GiveWell. When you give to charity, how much impact will your donation actually have? This question can be hard, if not impossible, to answer. Most charities just can't tell you how your money will be used or how much good it'll accomplish. You may know it could theoretically help a cause, but how? Or more importantly, how much? If you want to help people living in poverty with evidence-backed, high-impact charities, we recommend you check out GiveWell. GiveWell spends over 40,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funds to a few of the highest impact evidence-backed opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives and will improve the lives of millions more. Using GiveWell's research is absolutely free. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. There's no need to sign up, no need to give any personal information. They want you to have it. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund you choose without taking a cut. So if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to GiveWell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout. Make sure that they know you heard about GiveWell from psych to get your donation matched. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of psych.
There's an issue here, which is, I think, approaches the same kind of question in a different way. So we could talk about what counts as an illness or disease and what doesn't. But suppose we're going to say, if only for the sake of argument, that major depression and social phobia and schizophrenia really are diseases or illnesses or enough akin to them that they should be treated in the same way. There's another question which remains, which is, are they discrete categories or are they sort of cutoffs on a continuum? And it's not the kind of thing you could answer just through sort of introspection. They're both possibilities. It's possible that we have a normal range of sadness, which is kind of adaptive. If you didn't feel sad, you probably would respond to the world in an appropriate way. Sadness is good. We feel sad to different degrees. And maybe it's just some people feel a little bit sadder than average. Some people feel sadder than them. Some people feel sadder than them. And it just keeps on going until you have serious major depression, where somebody cannot leave their bed, where somebody just weeps all the time. And there's just a continuum. And then we decide where to have a cutoff. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is, no, it doesn't work like that. It's like being pregnant. It's like having COVID. There's normal variation, something or another. But then there's a real category of major depression, which is different, which is something above and beyond, which is something special. And I don't think it's the kind of thing where you can kind of sit and think really hard and figure out what it is. But I think the view that these things lie on a continuum is getting taken increasingly seriously by scholars.
That's interesting. Yeah, I suspect that whatever the truth of the matter is might vary depending on the disorder that we're talking about. I do know that there's some people who would resist the depression being just sort of like lots of sadness story, because the category of depression includes real anhedonia, real lack of ability to feel anything. So it's not just that they're extra sad, it's that they're suffering from all those other symptoms that you were talking about as well, that don't seem to co-occur when people are just feeling sad. But it's a hard question to answer because, for one, the way in which we measure these things is often just in a continuous way, right? We have scales. So we have a psychopathy scale. The psychopathy scale is a checklist administered by psychiatrists who are trained in psychopathy, and they ask you, really, they boil it down to 20 specific behavioral or psychological traits. They score you on each of these, either a 0, 1, or a 2. And so the maximum score on this is a 40. But the cutoff is unclear. Like, what makes somebody a psychopath? Is it a score of 30? Is it a score of 32? And it turns out that that answer is different depending on who you ask.
Right. So if you study prison populations, they tend to put the cutoff fairly high because these are kind of rather rough and callous and tough people. If you study university students, you put the cutoff lower. And as such, once you have a scale, you sort of buy into a continuous view or taking one seriously. So there was a paper in 2021 that asked what percentage of the population is psychopathic. And they tested 11,000 people. And they came with an answer of 4.5%. But as they notice, they said, well, that's because they put a cutoff. I think for their cutoff, it was 30. If the cutoff is 32, you get fewer psychopaths. If it's 25, you get more psychopaths. Now, this doesn't mean that psychopathy is in reality lying on a continuum, because it's possible there's something really discrete that some proportion of the population, let's say 4.5%, have that's genuinely different from everybody else. Their brains just work in different ways, but all we have is the scale. And so we just use the scale. But if we knew more about it, we would have a much better diagnostic item. We'd have a blood test. We'd have a brain scan that would say, you are psychopaths. The rest of you, maybe you're in some ways unempathic or less self-control or glib or whatever, but you're not psychopaths.
Right. You're just despicable.
You're just bad, bad people.
Right. And when you look at these scales, you can see the issue, right? So some of these questions are really attempts at indirectly getting at what is probably believed about psychopathy. Part of the psychopathy checklist includes questions about criminal history. Has this person actually been arrested for committing a violent crime before? Now, suppose that it is like an on-off thing. Some people are psychopaths, some people aren't. That question will probably capture a lot of psychopaths. But if you are a psychopath and you were raised in a very, say, wealthy environment where you wouldn't be committing the kinds of crimes that get you arrested, you're not going to score on that one. And so what you get is variability that's just due to noise, not because it's actually accurately assessing variability in the trait.
That's right. The idea here is that there'd be some sort of essential feature of a psychopath. And these scales don't, they get at things that correlate with the essential feature, but they don't get at the essential feature. Just like there's all sorts of features that are associated with having COVID, but you don't have to have all of them to have COVID. You could not have COVID and have some of them. Ultimately, we have tests that determine the truth of the matter. And to believe that psychopathy is a discrete category is to assume that, at least in principle, there'd be some sort of test that would distinguish the psychopaths from non-psychopaths.
And even if it is a discrete category, like a disease you either have it or you don't, it clearly could show up differently in different patients. Yeah. Some people's cancer is much more serious than somebody else's cancer. Nobody's arguing that cancer doesn't have something essential about it being a cancer, but you could observe some variability.
That's right. Reading the literature and seeing the discoveries made had some surprises for me. And I think the biggest surprise was I'd always thought that schizophrenia was your perfect example of a totally discrete disorder. Schizophrenia involves a loss of touch with reality. And this shows up in every aspect of mental life, in emotions and motivation and cognition. Individuals with schizophrenia have problems with learning, with memory, with processing speed, with attention. And I thought it was like the psychological disorder just ravages you and is separate. But some psychiatrists and some therapists that I trust have pointed me to recent research making the case that actually this too is on a continuum. There's sort of normal functioning where there's a really clear-headed, clear-eyed view of the real world. And then it's a continuum where you could have a bit of schizophrenia. And it occurs to me that if this is a continuum, a lot of other things could be too.
It's even unclear. So my understanding is that the things that make schizophrenia are sometimes also present in people with bipolar disorder. So people who are experiencing mania often get diagnosed as schizophrenic because they experience some of the positive symptoms, having hallucinations, delusions of grandeur. There's a difference in the UK and in the US when you present with these symptoms, whether you're going to be diagnosed as bipolar or schizophrenic. So this is all making me think that whatever the neat presentation of categories we have, like the story is so much more complex than that.
Yeah, and you could go two directions with that. One is you could say this calls into question the very notion of categorizing things and trying to find a deeper basis. A different way to go, which I'd be more tempted by, I'm curious what you think, is to say, well, there's a real fact of the matter. And common sense tells us that, well, you know, major depression when you're sad just naturally goes with bipolar, where you're sad and sometimes manic. But in reality, we've discovered that bipolar depression might actually be very different from major depression. And in fact, it turns out that there's different genetic precursors. So if you have genes that predispose you for depression, they're not the same genes that predispose you to bipolar depression. In fact, consistent with what you're saying, there's more of a genetic connection with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. And you're right, they both could lead to psychosis. And it might be, I mean, it should be, if this is a good science, that when we start bringing together genes and careful studies of the environment and careful studies of the brain and neurochemistry and so on, the categorization we're going to get of mental disorders isn't going to be the common sense one.
Right.
Things are going to end up together. You wouldn't have thought that they go together, but they do. And this is the way diseases work in general. You know, wow, there's two different types of diabetes. wow, that thing which you thought was a cancer isn't really a cancer at all. It belongs to another category. When you do science, it shakes up your natural categories and puts them in different ways.
That's a nice way of putting it. And there is an effort by psychiatrists and clinical psychologists to come up with a categorization scheme that relies less on outward symptomatology. So the DSM is very straightforwardly a manual that categorizes people on the basis of the observed symptoms. So if you have 6 out of 9 of these and you've had them for X amount of time or longer, then you have depression. And I think there's long been a sense that this can't be the best way to carve up the world of mental disorders, because we realize that what we're seeing is simply symptomatology. We want to get at the deeper categorization. So there is a push. There is, in fact, a group working on a separate categorization scheme that would look more closely at the etiology that we're looking for in other diseases.
That's right. I want to give a really good quote by Thomas Insel, who used to be the director of National Institute of Mental Health. And at one point he says, we're not going to use the DSM. We're going to fund billions of dollars of research, but we're not going to use the DSM because their criteria aren't scientific. And actually here he says, unfortunately, they do it differently than other medical professionals. So he writes, unlike our definition of heart disease, lymphoma, or AIDS, the DSM diagnoses are based on consensus about clusters of clinical symptoms, not any objective laboratory measure. In the rest of medicine, this would be equivalent to creating diagnostic systems based on the nature of chest pain or the quality of fever. So what he then goes on to say is the NIMH would instead pursue a more scientific taxonomy that's grounded in neuroscience and genetics. And, you know, we're going to talk about treatment now, but he claimed that this would not only give us better science and a better understanding, but lead to revolution in treatment.
You know, I don't want to push the line that illness is a mere metaphor, but if it is, then this is not going to bear fruit in the way that he might think. But I guess we'll find out.
Right. So in some ways, sort of to sum up where we are, there's these problems of things blurring together and subtleties of how to diagnose things. And there's two ways to respond. Maybe you're more sympathetic at first, I'm more sympathetic the second. The first is to say, maybe this calls into question this whole way that we're thinking about it, in terms of as if akin to lymphoma and heart disease and so on. The second way is we got to try harder and try to build more of a science of it. And then these categories have become more clear and more objective.
I suspect that this is a question that can't have a single answer. Some things that we call mental illness are going to be very much like illness, and some things are going to be more like the personality disorders, more like just issues with the way that a person is functioning psychologically for whatever reason, but not in that the medical model isn't really capturing what's going on. And so you have illnesses that you were mentioning before, like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, which are in the DSM. But now that we know that these are really, I mean, these are diseases with psychological manifestations that give psychological symptoms, I don't know that I would call them mental disorders. The minute I learn that something has this very clear biological genetic cause in the same way as other illnesses, I feel like I shuffle them over to the side now. And I say, now those are proper diseases. And whether or not that happens to something like schizophrenia or major depressive disorders or generalized anxieties is an open question. But I don't know. What do you think?
So we're friends here, and I don't want to be too harsh, but are you worried as a bit dualist about what you're claiming, which is there's the realm of the physical and the brain and real things. And, you know, Parkinson's is a real problem. But something like post-traumatic stress disorder, social phobia, won't be real in the same sense. And I think that might be true, but I worry whether there's something a little bit arguing that there should be a sharp distinction between the mind and the brain.
It's a very good objection. And I think that the only thing that I would say is, first, this is the tentative thoughts on my part. What I really want to say is that there's no reason to think that all of the things in the DSM are going to have the same answer. But two, my response would be that no, it's in fact you reading into something about the stuff of psychology as being not real. I didn't mean to imply that at all, but rather just to imply that there are, in fact, bona fide psychological disorders that for which we wouldn't necessarily have anything like a clear biological cause, but that nonetheless would be distressing and disruptive. Of course, it's all caused by the brain, but you know, in much the same way that the next thing I'm going to say is caused by the brain. But that doesn't mean I'm a dualist to say that you're looking in the wrong place if what you want to do is an fMRI to see what I'm going to say next.
So here's where I think we stand. Tell me if you think this is right, which is in the future, our science progresses, we get better and better, 50 years in the future, it will still have in the DSM Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. It won't have borderline personality and histrionic personality disorder. It'll just say, oh, you know, I don't know why we put those there. And then the question is, how will it treat things like social phobia and post-traumatic stress disorder? And I'm more inclined to think in the end, it's going to be treated more like Parkinson's, where it's this part of the brain, this genetic cause. You think maybe it's still obviously the brain and obviously, you know, physical, but it will end up being treated in kind of a different way than these other things.
Yeah, I guess that's where I would stand.
Yeah.
And maybe this is a good segue into a discussion of treatment, because I do think that depending on what model you have about what mental illness is, you might have a very different view of how to treat it. And I think there's compelling evidence for both sides. On the one hand, we know that there are drug treatments that work very well. And we know, even in some cases, like bipolar disorder, lithium, a mood stabilizer, works for that in a way that SSRIs don't. And so the fact that there are different chemical treatments that might affect these diseases differently might be evidence. You might say this is evidence that these are, in fact, more like diseases.
And in a conciliatory way, I'll point out that since many therapies work by having people talk through their problems, having people work on exercises to respond better to the world, that could point to the idea that, you know, obviously still the brain, but it's not the same sort of thing as a more physical disorder.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not sure, Paul, what I believe here, because it's true that at the end of the day, all of our psychology is caused by the brain. And when I'm left with the question, how should I attack this particular disorder? And I'm told that therapy works wonders, talk therapy works wonders for this one. Drugs work less. I don't know what I want to conclude about those two, because obviously these are just two different levels of analysis about how behavior is formed.
Yeah. And just to make a point, the facts say that a drug might affect something and maybe improve a situation doesn't essentially mean the cause of the situation is itself biochemical. I mean, go back to previous example. Imagine somebody in terrible grief because their child just died. It seems likely that some sort of drug will help them sleep, will take away some of their extreme anguish. But this doesn't mean their original problem was ultimately biochemical. Their original problem was because their child just died. And so we got to be careful this pulling apart the idea of what works for treatment versus what's the cause of something.
Yeah, headaches aren't caused by lack of aspirin, right?
That's right.
I'll tell a personal story. I once went to a psychiatrist and said, I think I might have ADHD. And he said, why? He said, because my sister-in-law gave me some Ritalin and it really, really helped. And he says, taking Ritalin is going to help everybody. doesn't mean anything about whether or not you're of course it made you more productive.
Yeah. On the flip side, alcohol sometimes relaxes me, but it doesn't mean I suffer from an alcohol deficit disorder. It means it relaxes a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right.
it's funny that we go for medications for you that improve productivity and for me diminish anxiety. So let's talk about therapy. And I guess maybe we'll just go back to what we started off with. My course, I've taught some courses which have been online, and I get a lot of emails with people who email me. And, you know, they see I'm a psychologist, they make the natural inference, and they tell me about their problems. And I immediately say, I'm not a therapist. I can't advise you about your problems. I'm not qualified. But I do tell them, I think you should see somebody. And this isn't just sort of a reflexive or glib dismissal. It's because I think there's really good evidence that therapy on the whole helps. Doesn't mean it helps everybody. It doesn't even mean that therapy is always beneficial. There are some specific cases where therapy has been shown to have bad effects. Certain programs, certain types of procedures, not very common anymore, can have negative effects on people. But for the most part, therapy, of the standard therapies, tend to do well. So we should talk a little bit about them. We've already talked about Freudian therapy, about psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic therapy earlier on, but there's others. So I'll ask you, what's your favorite therapy?
What a question. It's like, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? I think I like CBT. Yeah. I have always been drawn to that kind of therapy that's sometimes referred to as existential therapy. It's a form of talk therapy where you and your therapist talk about sort of big problems of existence. I suspect that this is because whatever malaise I've had in the mental domain has generally been about things like, is my life worth living? is it going to matter when I die? My big fears of death.
Therapy for privileged people.
It's therapy for privileged people. So, but I think that it is a good world if that's the therapy that people need the most. It would mean that we're all in a good enough position to be deeply reflective about meaning in life.
Yeah, that's a nice hope for the future.
Right. But I've seen in people whom I know and love, I've seen cognitive behavioral therapies work wonders, and specifically for disorders like phobias, generalized anxiety, even obsessive compulsive disorder, the kinds of therapies that attack that anxiety category. Cognitive behavioral therapy really seems to have good outcomes for a lot of those patients.
Yep. My favorite therapy to watch in movies and TV and to think about is Freudian therapy, because you get into these dreams and these complex,
The Sopranos.
Oh, amazing. These great narratives about why Tony has his panic attacks and all of this. But my intuition is the same as yours. If I was struggling with a real specific problem, an obsession, unrealistic fears, anxiety, sadness, I would also seek out cognitive behavioral therapy. It seems to have the most bang for the buck. The behavioral part refers to the sort of theories that based on sort of Skinnerian theories of, say, operant conditioning, where you reward behaviors to make them increase, punish them, to make them go away. Exposure therapy, which kind of works on classic conditioning principles. And the cognitive part is often kind of get you thinking right, to get you out of in good sort of habits of thought, to avoid obsessive dwelling on bad ideas, to question your unrealistic thoughts. If Freudian therapy is so mysterious with the sort of bearded psychiatrist, you know, and looking down, taking notes while the person's lying on the sofa talking about their dreams, CBT is you're in a brightly lit room across a table, and a person says, here's what we're going to do to help your problem, and here's why we're going to do it. There's nothing hidden. It's just straight. Here's the techniques we're going to work on together. We're going to assign you homework. I'm going to answer any question. I'll give you papers to read to see it. And it tends to be quite successful.
Yeah. In fact, I had an experience with this lack of mystery / effectiveness of cognitive behavioral therapy. When I was in college, I took a course, I believe it was called Behavior Change. And one of the assignments was to pick a behavior that we wanted to change. So mine, Paul, was that I wanted to stop cursing.
So this is a story of an unsuccessful intervention, I guess.
We're not making any claims about long-term effectiveness okay. here. But what I learned to do was every time I cursed, I would write it down. And within a couple of weeks, I stopped cursing completely. What it was doing was interrupting the automatic nature of my thought processes, and it worked.
Good. Temporarily.
What I realized really in my existential therapy is that life without cursing is meaningless.
your therapist battled one another. Yeah. And we're talking about therapies, and then there's drugs. So some very large proportion of people are on some sort of drug for depression or anxiety or some other disorder. Some fairly large proportion of people listening to us are currently taking such a drug. And it's not like you take a pill and your problem goes away. It takes a while often to figure out the right drug for the right person. Many of these drugs have side effects. Sometimes a drug works for a while and stops working. But on balance, drugs for depression, anxiety do pretty well, typically in sort of concert with some sort of talk therapy like CBT. So We've been talking now about these therapies and these drugs, and I think it'd be irresponsible for us not to say that they do work on balance. But the flip side of this is clinical psychology, I think, is at a fairly primitive state. And in some way, I'm going to put that a bit stronger. I think psychology has had its success stories where we've really helped explain things. We've talked about some of the success stories so far. I'm not sure if clinical psychology has been a success story in the same way. I'm not sure that in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been huge developments. So I want to go back to Incel. So Incel said, I'm head of NIMH. I'm on a National Institute of Mental Health. I want to sort of have a much more scientific foundation for clinical studies. And after he left NIMH, he confessed that it was not the success he wanted it to be. So here's the quote, and it's very striking to me. I spent 13 years at NIMH really pushing on the neuroscience and genetics of mental disorders. And when I look back on that, I realize that while I think I succeeded getting a lot of really cool papers published by cool scientists at fairly large costs, I think $20 billion, I don't think we moved the needle in reducing suicide, reducing hospitalization, improving recovery for the tens of millions of people who have mental illness. And his predecessor at NIMH, Steve Hyman, had a similar quote. He said, no new drug targets or therapeutic mechanisms of real significance have been developed for more than four decades. And I find that just shocking, but I think it's true. I think if you have a mental illness now, your treatment would not be substantially different than if you had it 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Some of the drugs are a bit better. I think some of the talk therapies are a bit better. They intend to incorporate things like mindfulness meditation now with some advantage, but it's not a revolution.
It's depressing, but I agree. And in fact, as far as I'm aware, many mental illnesses have increased. So right now it seems to me that, for instance, many more of my students suffer from depression and probably ADHD than have in the past. Suicide rates, they've probably gone up. It's a real question as to why. What's going on? I think one hint comes from the fact that, you know, when we talk about the diathesis stress model of these diseases, that stress part really does matter. And in a world where the conditions of life might change for the worst, we're going to see mental illness incidents go up. So I think the COVID pandemic, for instance, took its toll on many of our younger students because of what it did to their social life and their ability to cope through social interaction. And if you want to move the needle, maybe you don't need to find the answer to what is the essence of depression, but rather you need to change the conditions that you know might give rise to more or less depression. I don't know what that says about what mental illness truly is or how to categorize it, but I do know that we know enough to know that some of the reasons that mental illness isn't going down is because of things that have just occurred in the world, the way that the world has changed.
Yeah, and there's debate over what these things are. Some of our colleagues implicate social media, particularly regarding young people, regarding younger women. But there's different theories about that. I agree with you. I think that making the world materially better and socially better, removing stress from people's lives will diminish mental illness. And there's some obvious cases of that. During wartime, people suffer from post-traumatic stress much more often because they're put into these terrible situations. I agree with that, but I would just say that that's half the story. I like an analogy with cancer here, which is one way to reduce the amount of cancer in the world is to remove carcinogens from the environment. Who could argue against that? But you could make the environment perfectly optimal and babies would get cancer and children would get cancer and people would get cancer. And so the problem wouldn't go away. And I think the same thing is true for mental illnesses, that even in the most perfect utopia we could imagine, for such a utopia to have maximum human flourishing, it would have to include treatments for social phobia, for schizophrenia, for depression, for all of these problems that some people will get, even in the best of worlds.
I think that's well put, and I agree with that.
We're accepting the power of both the environment and the social world, and also perhaps genetic factors, perhaps idiosyncratic personal factors. For some people, distress is the stress of war and the stress of extreme poverty, and we could fix that. But for some people, the stress might be heartbreak. And what are you going to do about that?
And if we are researchers of the mind and we want to understand how these things work, it still remains a puzzle, a fundamental puzzle about how the mind works, that these mental illnesses still rear their head after all this time.
I think that that's true. And I think that here's where we could converge. I think the very notion of mental illness and the very notion of treatment for mental illness is in part a psychological one, and, you know, actually part a genetic one and part a neuroscience one. But it's also in part a moral and political one. Regardless of whether these disorders are continuous and discrete, for instance, society could choose to treat somebody who's been depressed one way and say, oh, you have an illness, you should get treatment, or say, no, it is a normal way of living. It's, I think, a difficult moral problem, what the right thing is to do in different situations. But here's a case where our discipline is not separate from more general ethical and social issues. It just sort of blends in with them.
Very well said.
Okay.
I think the solution for you will be to go have a drink, and I will go have some Ritalin.
Okay.